I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, up next.
Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. It has been my pleasure and privilege both to explore an extraordinary and massive book called The Romanovs, 1613 to 1918. And in this book, historian Simon Sebag Montefiore explores the extraordinary story of the Romanov family that led Russia through years of glory and years of terrible pain and turbulence. It is 304 years we are talking about and 20 different sovereigns. And much of this history has never been spelled out before in this kind of rich detail. And it is a story that is also told very much with the sense of narrative. I mean, this is the story of human beings, often deeply flawed human beings, and often trying to exert their power and influence in arenas filled, riddled with intrigue of one kind or another. It is a work that is deeply satisfying and fascinating on every page. And you may know the name of Simon Sebag Montefiore from previous books, such as Catherine the Great and Potemkin, The Imperial Love Affair, and Stalin, The Court of the Red Tsar. Mr. Montefiore has won a number of different awards for his fine, fine work. He is speaking to us from London. And this book, again, is called The Romanovs, 1613 to 1918, published by Vintage, a division of Penguin Random House. Simon Sebag Montefiore, we welcome you to the morning show.
Lovely to be with you. Hello.
I'm really, really honored to be speaking with you, and I must say this is an extraordinary accomplishment. I wonder, as you set about writing this history of the Romanov family, you surely had a pretty good sense of just what a sprawling and intimidating challenge this would be. As you actually ended up sitting down to write the thing, did it prove to be even a greater challenge than you anticipated?
Yes. This has been a huge and daunting task, but a real joy to write. I wanted to write something that was readable by anybody, even if they've never really heard of any Russian history. So you can read it as a sort of saga of great characters of sex, murder, debauchery, power, ambition, empire. Or you can read it as a sort of study of why Russia is Russia today, why Putin, why Ukraine, why Crimea. Or you can just look at it as a study of power itself. And, of course, it's amazingly relevant now because of what's happening in the Kremlin and in your White House. And so, you have a president who kind of wants to be really the first American czar. And you have a president, Putin, who is really channeling so much of the Romanovs in the way he rules and sees the world. And so, I wanted to explain why Russia is so singular. And, gosh, it turns out this is the moment to do it. And I think this book is for that reason rather timely.
Absolutely. And, of course, it's timely even apart from the fact that we will soon be seeing the 100th anniversary of the brutal murder of the last Tsar and his family. In your acknowledgments, you graciously acknowledge a couple of previous works about the Romanov family, but then go on to say that what you have attempted to do here and succeeded in doing is something that no previous book has really attempted. Explain how your book is, while it is to some extent dependent on what has been written before, is a work, in a sense, really like none other.
Yes, I mean, the strange thing is that there have been some other books on the Romanovs. It's a subject where when you hear it, you probably think, wow, I think we've read so many books on this before. Actually, there are none, virtually. And you know, no one has really written a narration. This is a book about 20 Tsars and Tsarinas, the whole dynasty, from Ivan the Terrible to Nicholas and Alexandra and Rasputin. It has amazing characters. It's full of famous ones like Peter the Great and Catherine the Great and her lovers, and of course Nikki and Alex. But it also has lots you won't have heard of. But to understand Russia and to understand the story of Russia and why Russia is like it is today, I take it right away from Ivan the Terrible up through the Tsar, through Stalin, to Putin. And then I hope that things begin to make sense. But this has everything, and it's based especially on the love letters and private letters of these Tsars, which are in the Russian archives. And some of them, all of them are very political. Many of them are very romantic. Some of them are very sexually explicit and will shock readers. But all of them go towards showing just how personal politics is and how everything political is personal, too. And again, this is something America, to its cost, is so discovering at the moment.
Right. You mentioned in the kind of materials to which you turn to fashion such a detailed history that a lot of what you have looked at has been quite neglected, some of it unpublished, some of it scarcely read at all by anybody. And you also, as you're kind of explaining this, make an intriguing distinction between memoirs, which you say must be treated with skepticism, and letters and diaries, which you clearly find to be much more valuable. First of all, just explain that distinction, and then talk about the letters that were especially interesting to you and helpful to you in fashioning this book.
Yes, I mean, I think that, I mean, with memoirs, you've got to be especially careful because often they're written by people in old age, and as we know from our own grandparents or even from ourselves, you know, one sort of tends to repeat stories and come to believe them, and you know, oftentimes those stories are very inaccurate. But the wonderful thing about letters, especially secret letters between partners or lovers, is that they really are the real voice at the time, and they were never meant to be published. And so this book is especially based on really private correspondence, which is a bit like reading someone's secret emails. And sometimes one's almost embarrassed to be reading this stuff. And I've built the book around, I mean, of course, it's built on an enormous number of official documents and ministers' documents and so on, but also around private letters. And, you know, these are the passionate love letters of, for example, Nicholas and Alexandra, which are political. They show how dependent they were on Rasputin. They show their folly, but they also show that, you know, their passionate romance, their sexual nicknames for each other's genitalia, for example. I mean, really shocking and embarrassing stuff. And then if you go backwards, you know, we've got the amazing correspondence of Alexander II. He was the Tsar who liberated the first, and he corresponded with President Lincoln, who was at the same time, in 1861, 1862, liberating the slaves of America. But the love letter of Alexander II and his mistress, Princess Katia, are so shocking. No one's really used them before. And they are the most sexually explicit letters ever written by a politician in all of history. And if you read them, you'll see what I mean. And then if you go back, you know, there's Catherine the Great's love letters with Potemkin. Now, he was her partner in power, really. He ruled with her. He was the love of her life as well. And he was as brilliant as she was. She was absolutely brilliant person, and he was too. And these letters, with their passion and politics and health and gossip, have everything. And, you know, the strange thing is that when you read the newspapers today, whether it's the New York Times or the Inquirer, you never really know. You presume that about 50% of what you read is true, but you never really know what happens in the bedroom or in the boardroom or in the cabinet office. But with these letters, you really do, and that's an exciting thing. So these are the great correspondences that this book is built around.
Mm. We're speaking with Simon Sebag Montefiore about his book, The Romanovs, 1613 to 1918. This is a sprawling book which tells the sprawling story of the Romanov family over the course of more than 300 years. Something else that you mention in the book's introduction that I think is worth our talking about is that this is, in so many respects, a story that is full of sensational, salacious sorts of details and events. I'll just read a couple of lines here of yours. You write, "The Romanovs inhabit a world of family rivalry, imperial ambition, lurid glamour, sexual excess, and depraved sadism. This is a world where obscure strangers suddenly claim to be dead monarchs reborn. Brides are poisoned. Fathers torture their sons to death. Sons kill fathers. Wives murder husbands. A holy man poisoned in shots arises, apparently from the dead. Barbers and peasants ascend to supremacy. Giants and freaks are collected. Dwarves are tossed. Beheaded heads kissed. Tongues torn out," and so on and so on. I read that because you go on to say that out of context, these excesses seem so overblown and outlandish that ascetic academic historians find themselves bashfully toning down the truth. So tell our listeners how you, as a very serious historian and very skilled writer, have tried to come to terms with this kind of material, this kind of reality, and write about it in such a way that, first of all, we can take in and believe and understand.
Well, that's the challenge, really. I mean, I'm someone who loves reading this sort of stuff, and that's why I write about Russia. It's why I don't write about small towns in England. And you know, I just decided I'm a very uninhibited writer. And I just decided to, you know, really confront this head on and, you know, to find out. You know, my aim is really to find out and show how these people lived, how power worked, how the court of an emperor works. And so I just followed that wherever it goes. And, you know, brutal security enforcement, torture are very much part of the Russian way. They still are. And, you know, so if you write about Russia, intimate history of Russia, you have to show this stuff. And of course, you know, being emperors and czars, you know, they have the power to sort of in their love life to have whatever lovers they like. And it just happens, and I'm fortunate enough that the material is so graphic, so intimate, that it'd be mad not to enjoy it and to show it. But you certainly don't need to make anything up in this story. And, you know, I mean, I treat my readers with great respect. I think they're capable of understanding quite complicated things, but also they're fascinated by personality and power. And I think we all are. And that's what this book, its heart is about.
Right. You write at one point, power is always personal. And, of course, that seems to have especially been true in the case of old Russia and the Romanovs. At one point in that, shortly after you say that power is always personal, you say, in any court, power is as fluid as human personality. I find that notion to be absolutely fascinating. Explain further what you mean by that, about the fluidity of power and how it's related to the matter of power always being personal.
Well, you know, what I meant by that is that, you know, power can flow different ways. Power can be given, but it can be taken away just as easily. And, you know, from a leader, for example, you know, and we may be about to see this in America itself, a leader can hold a post of absolute power, that, you know, he can be crowned emperor, and yet he can actually see gradually that the power drain away from that position, even though he seems to hold all the keys to it. At the same time, a powerful person, a president, or a czar in this case, can give power to one person, and all power from the crown can flow to that person, who can become the omnipotent favorite. But a week later, the president or the czar or whatever can take it back, and that person goes to nothing. So power is always fluid and personal, and the more powerful the principal character is, the more powerful the czar, the more capable he is of capriciously giving power to whomsoever he or she chooses. And that's what this book is really about. And, of course, that's been the case particularly in Russia, where Rasputin, an uneducated peasant, became so powerful he could pick the prime minister of the biggest empire in the world. Or in the reign of Emperor Paul, where his barber, who was a Turkish boy, became a count and the most powerful minister, again in the empire, to Catherine the Great, who made Potemkin her partner in ruling. So, and of course, you know, to hark back to today, you know, President Putin or President Yeltsin have regularly raised people in Russia to become multi-billionaires and taken it away as well. And then I don't even need to mention what's happening in America today. So power is always fluid, and that's why, in a way, this book is a sort of study of power everywhere, because it's universal, and it, all courts of powerful men, of potentates, work the same way.
And, of course, the reality also is that great power can be given to someone who can use that delegated power to support the supreme leader, or that power can also be used to undermine that leader. Or there can always be the suspicion that is occurring, even if it isn't actually occurring. And I think that's part of why you talk about this as being kind of an invisible, mysterious alchemy of power. I mean, there is...
Yes, I mean, that's one of the things that we study here, is that the alchemy of power. I mean, someone on the way up has that alchemy in spades, but it can drain away as well and vanish. And then someone can be left with all the trappings and all the titles and have no power whatsoever. At the same time, someone with no official role, I mean, for example, when Putin was just prime minister and somebody else was president, he was still the most powerful man in the country. And so this sort of thing is always fluid. And, of course, when you're talking about trust, you know, first of all, I mean, you can, czars often delegated power to a favorite who then undermined them and arranged their murder. So, you know, the people who are most dangerous are often those closest to you. And that's one of the reasons that, you know, all Russian leaders are so vigilant and so obsessed with security, because when we look from the outside, we see the Tsar to be omnipotent, or we see President Putin to be omnipotent. But from their point of view, in a system with no checks or balances or barriers or boundaries at all, they are very vulnerable to be destroyed. So a sort of state of perpetual vigilance is essential.
Right. And especially in the first century of this 300-year history, in which you tell us there was really not all that clear or predictable a fixed order of succession. And so that would make that point of succession again and again and again a point of contention and a source of great unrest and turbulence.
Yes, I mean, that's, you know, I mean, you've got it. I mean, in the first century and a half or whatever it was, there was no line of succession, so anyone could be chosen. And of course, in Russia today, again, there's no line of succession. Bizarrely, you know, President Putin chose his successor, President Yeltsin chose his successor, almost at random. And so, strangely, things are playing out again, and the Kremlin today has such similarities with the Romanov court. But you're right, in the first century and a half, there was no, anyone could be czar, and czars could choose their successors, or more often, they just died and the court chose the successor. But then they had a rule of succession in the 19th century right up till Nicholas II.
We're speaking with Simon Sebag Montefiore, the author of The Romanovs, 1613 to 1918. Well, there is no way in the scope of this particular interview that we can make our way painstakingly through each and every fascinating figure that whose stories you recount in your book. But we should touch on at least a few specific figures and have you at least say a little bit about them. And then I think that will entice our listeners to seek out your book and read about these people in greater detail. One thing I'm really intrigued about is how you frame this sprawling 300-plus year history by talking about two boys and how, in a sense, the story of the Romanovs begins with and ends with young boys, in a sense, caught in situations which they do not deserve to experience. Explain that framework.
Well, you're right. You know, this in some ways, this is a family story, and it is a family like yours and mine, except that it's a family where fathers torture their sons to death, where wives have their husbands murdered, where sons have their fathers murdered. So it's a kind of family that is kind of unnaturalized by power, by the corrosive influence of power. And of course, children are, you know, the great victims of power and of the expectations of royal duty. And so when I was thinking about how to understand this this dynasty, I realized that it had begun and ended with two boys, both young, both in their early teens, both sickly, both unsuited, really, for the pressures of royal rule. And I thought that would be an interesting way to begin the book, and I wondered if it would work, intercutting the moment, the key moments in their lives. And so for the first one is the first czar of the Romanov dynasty was Michael Romanov, and he was suddenly acclaimed as czar, and he was totally unsuitable to be czar. He was ill, he was sickly, he was lame, he had a tick on his face, he had a twitch, he was uneducated, he was illiterate, and he was weak. And yet he was chosen as czar at the greatest crisis in Russian history, because that was the time of trouble, 1613, when Russia was being invaded from every side. It was a failed state. And he didn't want to be czar, and his mother didn't want him to be czar, but he was forced to become czar. But the pressure of making him monarch actually made him weak with terror. And over 300 years later, in a sort of shadow of the first story, the heir to the throne was Alexei Romanov, the son of Nicholas and Alexandra, the last Tsar and last Tsarina. And so I end. I look at that scene where the Romanovs are woken up in the middle of the night, and they are brought down downstairs in the house of special purpose in Yekaterinburg, and there they are told to wait in a room, and suddenly the assassins come in, and they face their end in the terrible slaughter of the entire family. And in the strain of these, in the stress and the fear of these two young boys, this frames the story of the House of Romanov.
Right. And, of course, it's so interesting to think about somebody desperately not wanting to be handed the reins of absolute power in Russia. But, of course, that was exactly the situation in 1613 with the country in such desperate turmoil, as it, of course, also found itself in a different kind of turmoil in 1918. And, of course, turmoil dogs so much of this history down through the centuries, and we follow each and every step through the course of your book. Say a quick word about two of the most famous and at least in some ways successful rulers who are part of this history, the two who are in a sense named the Great.
Well, Peter the Great is the great the greatest ruler in Russian history, but one of the greatest statesmen in any country's history. And he is the one that all the Tsars afterwards wanted to emulate, all the Romanov Tsars. He's the one that Stalin wanted to emulate. He's the one that President Vladimir Putin wants to be. And he was extraordinary. Everything about him was exceptional. He was 6'7". He was a giant. He was terrifying. He was half genius, half monster. He knew what he wanted. He wanted to make Russia modern, but not modern in an American sense, in a Western sense. He wanted to make Russia efficient, to get Western military technology, to make Russia into a military superpower, to take on the West. And he achieved that, and he founded St. Petersburg. But he did it by being a tyrant, and he did it with brutal means. He tortured his enemies to death. He tortured his own son to death. Anyone who crossed him was arrested in cases that were very similar to those in style of those run by Stalin many centuries later. And he also was fascinated by death and by bodies, by taking them apart, by medicine. And he held wild orgies, wild parties, where the drinking was so heavy that people died of alcohol poisoning. His government ministers got into fights and killed each other, and where naked girls and dwarfs were jumping out of pies, and ministers in the government were riding around stark naked on donkeys and bears. So, you know, he lived in a world that was sort of part carnival and part grim military machine, and that was Peter the Great.
And, of course,
Catherine the Great.
Yes.
And Catherine the Great is the other great. And, by the way, not many families have two geniuses, but the Romanovs did, as well as a lot of other pretty competent rulers. But Catherine the Great was very different from Peter, of course. She was a woman, and she was a political genius. She was extremely humane. And I say that despite the fact that she had her own husband overthrown and then pretty much murdered. She didn't give the actual order, but she knew it was going to be done, I believe. But once she was Tsarina, she was really an astonishing character, highly cultured, very westernized. Of course, she was German by birth. Very attractive. She was curvaceous, blue-eyed. She was very ambitious for Russia. And she was who expanded Russia into to take Ukraine, to take and annex a place called Crimea. She took Russia into the Near East, the Middle East. She annexed the Caucasus. She bombarded Syria. So she has many parallels with today. And at the same time, she had her notorious love life, her sex life. And she was really a serial monogamist. She only had 12 lovers in her lifetime. She died at about 68. So that's about as many lovers as the average student these days has in one semester. So her reputation as an infomaniac is not deserved. Many of her choices of lover were unsuitably young and absurd, but she did choose the greatest statesman of the entire Romanov dynasty, Prince Potemkin, as her lover. And their partnership, which is told in the lovely letters, the amazingly passionate love letters that we talked about earlier, their love affair was really so successful politically as well. It was passionate. But it was also incredibly successful in terms of annexations, expansion of the Russian Empire, and their relationship was a very touching one. So she was the other great. But there were also, you know, Alexander I, who defeated Napoleon and marched all the way to Paris. He's the Tsar of War and Peace, of Tolstoy's War and Peace. And Nicholas I, who ended up being defeated in the Crimean War. And Alexander II, the one who corresponded and admired Lincoln so much, and he was the one who freed the serfs, and he was assassinated. And I should say, ruling Russia is a very hard job. It's a very dangerous job. Today, as it was then, 6 of the last 12 Tsars were actually murdered. So that gives you an idea of the challenge. And that's why, in the last century of the Romanovs, whenever a young man learned that he was going to be the heir to the throne of Russia, he just burst into tears. It was a terrifying job, and it remains terrifying today. You know, it's a dangerous job to have, even for President Putin. But right. I must say, just to bring it up to present day, President Putin has achieved things that no czar and no general secretary of the Communist Party has achieved with his success. He's managed to cause havoc in Russia's greatest rival, America.
It would be so tempting to spend some time talking about some of the entertaining details about somebody like Anna, who engaged in all kinds of cruel games, you write, like an omnipotent schoolgirl bully, or Elizaveta, who banned ladies from wearing pink. I mean, there's all kinds of examples of how absolute power can certainly corrupt absolutely. But I think it would be really interesting to spend a moment talking about some of what Alexander II attempted to do. He was Tsar, 1855 to 1881. And there are not very many so-called good guys in this account. He would be one of them that would be one of the more admirable figures. And one of the things you say is that he rose to power at a time that was incredibly challenging. But he came to power as perhaps the best prepared of anyone who assumed leadership of Russia. Just say a word about this situation.
Yes, I mean, you've had a good choice there. I mean, you've mentioned two of the kind of great monstrousness of the 18th century. You know, Empress Anna, who insisted on having dwarf tossing, dwarf throwing contest, and when the dwarfs grumbled, they were beaten. So she was a sort of ogress out of Game of Thrones. And of course, Elizaveta, who was the most beautiful of any of these rulers, and was really a true nymphomaniac, and was also obsessed with haute couture, with fashion. She was the kind of fashionista empress. But you're right to choose Alexander II of all of them, because he was the most attractive and the most endearing. He was good-looking, very charming. He had great sex appeal. He wasn't the greatest genius of all the rulers, and that would be Peter the Great. But he was, well-meaning, genial, generous, and a great sensualist, a great womanizer, of course. But also, he was flexible, and he understood that while he believed in autocracy, Russia had to be reformed, and so he brought in really brave reforms: jury trial, local town councils elected. And he liberated the serfs. He emancipated the slaves of Russia. So, and that's why he corresponded, as I said, with Lincoln. And they were both assassinated, ironically. So he was really an interesting. He was also the Tsar, by the way, who sold Alaska to, which was Russian America, it used to be called. He sold Alaska to America for a few million dollars, and he faced. He faced appalling challenges, though, because once he started these reforms, he couldn't stop them, and he raised expectations, with the result that terrorists started to hunt him down to destroy him, and he was literally hunted like an animal. His train was blown up, the Winter Palace was blown up, he was shot at in the street, and the only thing that consoled him was the love of Katya Dolgorukaya, who's the beautiful, very sensual girl whose outrageous love letters are in the book. And in the end, he realized that he had to go back to reform. And he was on the verge, literally on the day that he signed the law that would bring in what would be an early version of a sort of semi-parliamentary government, an elected assembly without powers, but with great potential. He was assassinated. He'd actually initialed it and set the date for its official signature, and that day he was assassinated. So this was the moment when Russia could have gone another way. The revolution could have been avoided, and Russian history could be completely different.
Right.
But he was assassinated that day. His son, who is the Tsar, by the way, who President Putin identifies with enormously, because just as Alexander II brought in reforms that brought Russia chaos, so Putin believed that Yeltsin had done that. And Alexander III, when he became Tsar, the son of Alexander II, immediately brought back conservatism, autocracy, a ruthless police state. And that's why Putin identifies with him, interestingly.
Yes. In whatever time remains, which I know is very little, just say a word about the unfortunate juxtaposition of, in a sense, the sweep of history, the circumstances of history, and the last of the Romanovs, Nicholas II, who, a decent man, but in so many ways incapable of meeting this great conundrum that confronted him.
Well, it was very unfortunate that, you know, the problems of Russia were more complicated, more interwoven, interconnected, and more impossible to solve at the end of the 19th century than they had been before. And yet there was a czar who was less capable than many, many of the czars who had gone before. And Nicholas II was an appalling judge of people. He was jealous of talented people. He was stubborn. He was rigid. He was vindictive. He was a kind family man. He loved his family, and he loved Alexandra. Unfortunately, he also recruited Alexandra into the government of Russia, which he didn't need to do. And she was also a rigid, vindictive, and deeply stupid, one of the stupidest women who ever dabbled in politics. And, you know, this is a family, one's got to remember, that has produced some of the most brilliant political women of all of history. You know, Catherine the Great, Anna the Better, and others, you know, were astonishing examples of the genius of women in power and the brilliance of women in power. But they also produced Alexandra, who was one of the worst. And her achievement was catastrophic, essentially. You know, during the war, they essentially destroyed the last credit of the empire. And that brought a revolution that just arose spontaneously, unplanned, and the Tsar was forced to abdicate. And there ended the dynasty. But that doesn't quite end the Romanov story, because the rulers who came afterwards, Kerensky, Lenin, and Stalin, and the Bolsheviks, seemed to be absolute enemies of monarchy. And yet, Stalin quite self-consciously created a Tsarist monarchy around himself and regarded himself as a Tsar. He said, the Russian people are Tsarists, and they need a Tsar, and I will be that Tsar. So in the book, I take this story right up through Russian power, right up from Lenin and Stalin and Brezhnev, right up to Yeltsin and Putin. And of course, Putin totally channels today the majesty and ambition of the House of Romanov, while also fusing that with the succession of the Stalinist general secretaries of the Communist Party. And of course, he's also a man of the present, a master of the internet and television and modern politics too. But he's a hybrid, and much of what he aspires to in Ukraine, the annexation of Crimea, for example, in the Middle East, is straight from the Romanov handbook. At the same time, you have the bizarre situation at the moment of an American president, Donald J. Trump, who really aspires to be a American czar, in effect, and who is enormously attracted to what he sees as the swaggering, omnipotent power of the Russian czar in the person of President Putin. And so what a strange time we have today, and perhaps it's never been a more relevant time to read and study the Romanovs, because much of what's happening today is explained in that story.
The story, again, is found in this book called The Romanovs, 1613 to 1918, now a paperback from Vintage Books, a division of Penguin Random House, and the author Simon Sebag Montefiore. Thank you so much, sir, for writing such a fascinating book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. I have enjoyed this. Best wishes.
I must say, I love talking to you. This has been such an enjoyable interview, and I love America, so I'm so delighted to speak to you all, and I hope to come over there soon. So thank you for having me, and hello to everybody.
You're welcome. And to finish out today's morning show, I want to read to you the epilogue from Mr. Montefiore's book, The Romanovs. The epilogue is titled Red Tsars, White Tsars. When Tsarevich Alexei was told that his father had abdicated, he asked, "Then who's going to rule Russia?" Karl Marx wrote that history repeats itself first as tragedy, second as farce. This was witty, but far from true. History is never repeated, but it borrows, steals, echoes, and commandeers the past to create a hybrid, something unique out of the ingredients of past and present. No tsars were to rule Russia after 1917, yet each of Nicholas's successors, who ruled the same empire with many of the same challenges in entirely different circumstances, channeled, adapted, and blended the prestige of the Romanovs with the zeitgeist of their own times. Lenin had lost Ukraine, the Caucasus, and much else at Brest-Litovsk, and without Ukraine, Russia would cease to be a great power. But ultimately, Lenin shrewdly reassembled the Romanov Empire, losing only Finland, Poland, and the Baltics. Even as Stalin outmaneuvered his rivals to succeed Lenin, he privately believed that Russia needed a czar. In April 1926, he mused that, although the party ruled, the people understand little of this. For centuries, the people in Russia were under a czar. The Russian people are czarist, accustomed to one person being at the head, and now there should be one. He studied Ivan the Terrible and Peter the Great particularly. The people need a czar, Stalin said in the 1930s, whom they can worship and for whom they can live and work. He carefully crafted his own image to create a new template of czar, fatherly and mysterious, industrial and urban, the leader of an internationalist mission, yet the monarch of the Russians. As the Germans advanced in 1941, he studied 1812 and in 1942-43 restored ranks, gold braid, and epaulets, and promoted czarist heroes Kutuzov and Suvorov. Stalin's terror allowed him to perform total reversals of policy, such as his pact with Hitler, to survive colossal self-inflicted disasters and force astonishing sacrifices from the Russians. His personal authority, homicidal brutality, Marxist nationalistic propaganda, breakneck industrialization, and command economy meant that he could deploy resources that would have been unimaginable to Nicholas. Stalin was a murderous tyrant, the Soviet experience a dystopian tragedy for the Russians. Yet he outperformed the czars, defeating Germany, leaving Russia as ruler of Eastern Europe and a nuclear superpower. He always measured himself against the Romanovs. In 1945, when the U.S. Ambassador Averell Harriman congratulated him on taking Berlin, Stalin replied, "Yes, but Alexander I made it to Paris." In 1991, the breakup of the Soviet Union was also the disintegration of the Romanov Empire that Lenin and Stalin had held on to with cunning and force. The very slyness of their 15-republic federation rebounded on those Marxist imperialists, for the republics were never intended to become independent. But Boris Yeltsin, the new leader of the Russian Federation, used the ambitions of the republics to outmaneuver Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev and dismantle the USSR. Millions of Russians now found themselves in new countries, while sacred Slavic lands, Ukraine or Crimea, were lost to the motherland. The decadent liberal West dared to push its influence into the new republics, Ukraine, Georgia, Estonia, right up against the borders of Russia. Yeltsin created what was, apart from the elected Constituent Assembly of 1918, the first real Russian democracy with a free press and free market. Like the czars before Paul I, he chose his own successor, Vladimir Putin, ex-KGB colonel turned politician, to protect his family and legacy. Putin's immediate mission was to restore Russian power at home and abroad. In 2000, his Chechen war ensured that the Russian Federation would stay together. In 2008, a war with Georgia, one of the more westernized republics, reasserted Russian hegemony over the Caucasus. In 2014, the West's attempt to recruit Ukraine into its economic system led Putin to launch an opportunistic war that enabled him to support a war of succession in eastern Ukraine and to annex Crimea, which he saw as our Temple Mount. His intervention in Syria in 2015 restores Russia's Middle Eastern aspirations from Catherine the Great to the Cold War. He called his ideology sovereign democracy, with the emphasis clearly on the sovereignty. Putinism blended Romanov authoritarianism, orthodox sanctity, Russian nationalism, crony capitalism, Soviet bureaucracy, and the fixtures of democracy, elections, and parliaments. If there was an ideology, it was bitterness towards and contempt for America, nostalgia for the Soviet Union and the Romanov Empire. But its spirit was a cult of authority and the entitlement to get rich in state service. The Slavophile mission of the Orthodox nation, superior to the West and exceptional in its character, has replaced that of Marxist internationalism. While the Orthodox Patriarch Kirill has called Putin a miracle of God for Russia, the president himself sees the Russian people as the core of a unique civilization. Peter the Great and Stalin are both treated as triumphant Russian leaders. Today's Russia is the heir of both, a fusion of imperial Stalinism and 21st century digital authoritarianism, stunted and distorted by its own personal caprice, old-fashioned lawlessness, economic sclerosis, and broad-getting corruption, however draped in the mantle of modernity. Looking back over the four centuries covered in this book, it is curious that each of Russia's times of trouble, 1610 to 13, 1917-18, and 1991 to 99, ended with a new version of the old autocracy, eased by the habits and traditions of its fallen predecessor, and justified by the urgent need to restore order, modernize radically, and regain Russia's place as a great power. Putin rules by the Romanov Compact, autocracy, and the rule of a tiny clique in return for the delivery of prosperity at home and glory abroad. Alexander II's minister, Count Beluviev, joked, "There is something erotic about adventures on exotic frontiers, and that it is certainly true of Russia's televisually spectacular military exploits in the Middle East. But as the later czars discovered, this gamble depends on economic success. Unlike them, however, Putin has the final resort of nuclear weapons." In his Russian exceptionalism, imperialistic pride, domestic conservatism, personal rule, and successful international aggression, Putin most resembles Tsar Nicholas I with his policies of autocracy, orthodoxy, nationality. During a 25-year reign, Nicholas II dominated and outmaneuvered the Western powers. Only war, defeat in the Crimean War, stopped him. But it is Nicholas II's father, Alexander III, with whom Putin most identifies. Alexander III ended Alexander II's messy liberal experiment to restore conservative authoritarianism, as Putin did after Yeltsin. The secret workings of power around one man in the 21st century Kremlin certainly resemble those of the Romanov emperors. There is no doubt that Putin is a skillful and opportunistic ruler who has again placed Russia at the center of world affairs while neglecting to reform. But his autocracy naturally allows him to make the sort of swift decisions that are now impossible in the divided, tentative democracies of the West. This swagger has won him admiration from those in the West frustrated with the perceived weakness of democracy. Donald Trump, who won the 2016 U.S. presidential election, promoting himself as a sort of American czar, declared his respect for Putin's undoubted success as a world leader and ruthless autocrat. Both pride themselves on being realists, but the realities of power may test their mutual regard. Putin's entourage call him the Tsar. Yet it is not the great Romanovs who keep Putin awake at night, but the memories of Nicholas II. One evening in his Novoogaryov Palace, his chief residence near Moscow, Putin asked his courtiers who were Russia's greatest traitors. Who were Russia's greatest traitors? Before they could answer, he replied, "The greatest criminals in our history were those weaklings who threw power on the floor, Nicholas II and Mikhail Gorbachev, who allowed power to be picked up by hysterics and madmen." Putin promised, "I would never abdicate." The Romanovs are gone, but the predicament of Russian autocracy lived on. The book again is The Romanovs, 1613 to 1918, by historian Simon Sebag Montefiore. The book is published by Vintage Books, a division of Penguin Random House. I'm Gregory Berg. And we're going to be talking politics over the next couple of days on The Morning Show. Tomorrow we will be hearing from Dr. Yuri Maltsev, on Friday from Dr. Jerry Mast, both from the faculty at Carthage College. And they each have very, very different perspectives from each other in terms of the presidency of Donald Trump. And you'll hear from them in the next couple of days on The Morning Show. Support for WGTV's Morning Show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in